Support for The Trend comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Coming up, conversation with the classical fusion group Montana Skies, along with excerpts from their Under the Beams performance in New Harmony. But first, we turn our attention to World Fair Trade Day, which is on Saturday. The recent tragedy at a garment factory in Bangladesh has put a lot of attention on where and how our clothes are made. Here to talk about fair trade are Anne Ennis. She has a passion for fair trade, born out of some trips to Nicaragua. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And Anne Ferguson is also here. She's the education coordinator for the fair trade market at Old North United Methodist Church in Evansville. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Anne Ferguson, let's start with you. You just got back a week or so ago from the Fair Trade Federation convention in Raleigh, North Carolina, and that was a national gathering. What was the response there to the building collapse in Bangladesh? How did that factor in?
It was on everyone's minds, and people were angry, but it was such a hopeful place because the Fair Trade Federation conference is a place where everyone in the Fair Trade Federation gathers to talk and discuss and help each other. Everybody wants everyone to succeed. So being in the fair trade movement means that you have solutions to problems like that in Bangladesh. And what you're working on is something that combats neglect that would let a factory collapse on 800 people, you know.
But Anne Ennis, we also see through this tragedy that we have so little control over many of the goods that we buy. You know, just I think single-digit percentage of clothes actually made in the U.S. that we buy. Companies that sell the clothes sometimes don't even know where or how things are being made. So some really big obstacles to overcome.
Yes. When I was in Nicaragua in 2001 and a few other trips in the shortly after that, I started having my eyes opened to what was going on in these sweatshops that are located all over South and Central America, and then also all over many parts of Asia. And the lack of any safety, the lack of even bathroom facilities, the long work days, the lack of pay. I mean, it's notorious, you know, that people are getting maybe 80 cents a day for 10-hour days, and they're working 6-7 days a week. If they complain about anything, they lose their jobs. What we find in this country when you come back is that is so far away from the mind of the person who is shopping in a retail store that it's really hard to get people connected to what those issues are. Someone told me with a Witness for Peace group in Nicaragua that in the days of slavery, the slaves were right there. You saw them. But here you've got people that are thousands and thousands of miles away, and you're in this lovely store with great lighting and great music, and you're getting a bargain. But I remind my family frequently that every bargain that you get means somebody isn't getting paid if you think about the number of hands it goes through before clothing gets to you.
So what do you do?
Well, I have committed our family. We only buy fair trade coffee, and we try to buy often fair trade chocolate candies. Those are things that are easy to get where you can feel like you're doing something. I did a lot of research early on when I got back from Nicaragua. I found a place. There's an online store called Maggie's Clean Clothes, and you can buy socks there and some really nice scarves. There's also T-shirts, all kinds of T-shirts. I do other research. I look around the internet occasionally. Every year or so, I do look. And, for example, The Gap several years ago came out with a social justice statement and a policy of what they were trying to do to control their suppliers in these countries. I heard many years ago, I did some research and found that Levi's was allowing unions to organize in their shops in Mexico and in Central America. So those are little things that make me think, okay, you know, Levi's, I'll pay a little more for a pair of Levi's because they're doing something good. You know, I'll go to the Gap and take a look around because they're doing something positive, recognizing that you cannot live in the United States of America as a quote-unquote normal citizen and do everything organic, fair trade, and know that, you know, you're not hurting somebody. The very act of wearing clothes in the United States, in Canada, in Northern Europe, is hurting somebody.
You're a really motivated consumer. though. So you're doing this research. I think people need to remember that there are places like the Fair Trade Market, like the River City Co-op, Elbert's, with people who know about this stuff, and you can use them as resources because they know about it. They want to share it.
So those are some of the resources that you could turn to, because it seems like fair trade runs into this issue of supply and demand, where you simply don't have the volume that's needed to meet all of our needs.
That's true. I did a little research as the education coordinator. I went around to the grocery stores on the north side and looked for fair trade coffee. And I was just looking at coffee. But there are other commodities that are sold through regular grocery stores. You just got to keep your eyes open and be aware of what the labels look like. And if you need help figuring out the labeling system, we can supply you with that information.
And some of those labels are like Equal Exchange, sort of a red and white label, or the Fair Trade Certified, which has two interlocking hands, black and white.
And the Fair Trade International Mark, which is green and black. Mm-hmm. And the labels don't necessarily, they're not the end of the world when it comes to fair trade, but they can be very useful tools to help guide your purchasing.
Do they guarantee anything?
Yeah, each system has their own way of certifying, and they all follow the general fair trade principles, which prevent child labor, promote environmental sustainability, promote transparency and accountability, all those kinds of things. So yes, they do. But I'm reluctant to say each one is the same, because there are variations on the
different systems. Yeah. So when you see one of these labels, and as the other thing you'll see nearby is the price, and it's higher than items that don't have that label. So where is that extra money going?
Well, it's going to the worker in the cooperative, or the worker in the garment factory, or the worker in the spinning factory that are making these fair trade certified products. It all comes down to if we all would pay a little bit more. And I've been told by Witness for Peace experts who are on the ground in Nicaragua, and this was in the mid, like 2004-5, I was doing some communication with them, 10 cents more for something that costs $5 can be enough, when you look at an international market, to provide a living wage to a family in many of these countries. So it's not exorbitantly expensive, but you do have to pay a little bit more. But to sleep in good conscience sometimes, I think that's worth it. You can make a donation to a charity, and that's a great thing. But when you buy your coffee, you're making an investment in, you know, changing the world in a little bit of a manner. And so it's minimal to make sure that you don't have to feel guilty about everything you do in order to live a upper middle class or middle class life in this country.
Ann Ferguson, we've heard a lot about coffee now, and I know you sell coffee, as we mentioned, at the Fair Trade Market. Is that one of the gateway, I hesitate to say drugs, but maybe in coffee that's the right term, but is that a good way into getting involved in fair trade? What are other entry points?
Getting involved in fair trade, or just buying fair trade?
Yeah.
It's a really easy way to buy fair trade, and it's one of the largest, I think it is the largest fair trade commodity worldwide, most purchased, most money involved in there. Food in general is the gateway. The UK, I think many of the grocery stores only sell fair trade bananas. So those have the largest supply chains. Food commodities have the largest supply chains and have the most presence. Chocolate is a big one. And a lot of people are becoming more familiar with fair trade coffee, fair trade chocolate. Fair trade tea, for sure.
One thing that I've seen over the last several years, there's a lot of universities that have had student-led efforts to buy only fair trade certified clothing, cotton clothing, and to make sure that the factories and the suppliers for their university emblazoned, you know, the logos and the merchandise for the university mm-hmm. are fair trade certified. I don't know if any of the local universities have done that, but, you know, some student groups in ways like that can make a big difference because
there's an entire national initiative mm-hmm. called Fair Trade Campaigns. And as part of that, you can start a student group and push to make your university a fair trade university.
Mm-hmm. Is all of this just a drop in the bucket?
Well, there's the saying of the kid that's walking on the beach and he's throwing up, there's all the starfish that have washed up on the beach and he's picking up the starfish and flinging them back in the ocean. And some other older man comes and tells him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm saving the starfish." And the man says, "Well, look at all these starfish. The water's going out. You can't begin to save all of them." And the child looks at the man and looks at the starfish and he says, "Well, I'm saving this one." And I was raised in a church group and a family where, you know, just because you can't do everything doesn't mean you don't do something. And if I can go to a fair trade market and I can pick up my staples, that's what I do. I buy my staple, you know, shelf stable goods at fair trade, and I buy my coffee. And if I can look up and occasionally try to make sure that even if I'm paying more for a pair of jeans or a pair of socks or a t-shirt, that it's not being made by a slave, I'm willing to do that, and I'm willing to tell other people to do that. And I'm kind of known for nagging other people about doing that. But, you know, what Old North is doing is just exemplary because it's a model where you can, you know, you can go in there and get quite a bit of things, items that you need. Also probably gift items, but then they're also, what Ann said is true, that, you know, if you go into places that are dealing with fair trade and organic, you can get a tie-in to some good information so you don't have to spend hours on the internet doing your own research.
I don't think either that there's a bucket to fill because all trade should be fair. So mm-hmm. the hope is that the existing trading systems will change to be fair and be more just and to take people into consideration as the priority instead of the bottom line as the priority. Keeping both in mind, really, because people need to make money and need to have a sustainable livelihood. So,
and to that note, a lot of people in this country spend a lot of time looking for the least expensive item, and they also spend a lot of time bemoaning the stagnant wages or lower wages. Well, until we've got the rest of the world up to a decent living wage and a some sort of guaranteed quality of life, wages in this country are going to never go back up. So this is a labor issue for the United States. And it can be, you can look at it selfishly that you've got a lot to gain from this too, because we've got to get everything raised for humanity reasons. But then if you don't want to look at it that way and you want to be a little cynical, it's also for your own good.
That's true. I think the global fair trade sales are over the 5 billion mark, and I think 1 billion of that is the U.S. So there's money out there to be made.
And Old North Fair Trade Market has an event coming up on Saturday in honor of World Fair Trade Day, a chance for people to, of course, shop, but also to learn more about what fair trade is and what they can do with their own spending habits.
Yes. So we'll have lots of things to buy and lunch and an experience room where you can talk to us and find out more, get your questions answered. We're also having two speakers, Bill Heminger, professor from UE, speaking at 10:30, and then Betsy Hopkins, a representative from Uncharted International, will be speaking at 1, and they'll be talking about their experiences and how those apply to the fair trade movement.
Well, we've been talking with Ann Ferguson. She is with the Old North Fair Trade Market, which is housed at Old North United Methodist Church on Evansville's north side. Also speaking with Ann Ennis, who is a fair trade advocate. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Micah.
You're listening to The Trend. Coming up, music and conversation with the cello guitar duo Montana Skies.
Support Support for WNIN comes from Tin Man Brewing Company, announcing their locally brewed beer varieties in cans and on draft are now available in local stores and locations. More information at tinmanbrewing.com. And from Evansville Day School, presenting Summer Academy, 9 weeks of educational and enriching programs offering a new theme each week. Summer Academy is open to all area students aged 3 by September 15th through entering 5th grade. Half day, full day, and extended care options are available. Details at 812-476-3039.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Our next guests are musicians who perform what they call classical fusion. We'll hear portions of a performance earlier this year as part of the Under the Beams concert series in New Harmony, Indiana. That's when they also took time to stop by our studio. John and Jen Adams are the cello guitar duo Montana Skies, and you both come from classical backgrounds. You studied, in your case, John, classical guitar, and in your case, Jen, classical cello at the University of Georgia. And I guess you wanted to play music together and then discovered that there actually isn't as much repertoire for that pairing of instruments as you had hoped. Talk a bit about what happened when you ran out of repertoire.
Well, it actually occurred pretty quickly because we had gone to the university library to look for music to play together, and we discovered that there was just a very small amount of music for cello and guitar, and much of it was 20th century music, and the rest was some arrangements of things like Vivaldi and older classic style music. So I think we discovered that pretty quickly. You know, we went through what we wanted to play from that and decided that we would sort of expand in our own direction. So we started with making our own arrangements and doing original compositions and expanding outwards from that point.
Had you done composition before?
No, never. I think that it was a little bit of a stall right away, you know, a stall out a little bit, but it was a blessing because we got to examine what we cared about musically, so that it was, you know, kind of forcing us to be authentic with our artistic expression and really exploring what kind of things we liked playing as more so than if we were just doing the
just saying
music.
here's the standard repertoire, we'll just play it because that's what
I mean. I'm sure it would have been awesome if there was that stuff too, but it's just that it's more personal for us because we've arranged so much of what we play and composed now. We started with arranging first, coming from classical. We started with arranging things like The Swan by Saint-Saëns, which is cello and usually maybe piano. And so, like, John would transpose and arrange the piano part, that kind of thing. And then it branched out to, hey, what would this sound like? And arranging things that weren't classical and composing things. John started with composing. And, you know, within a short amount of time, he composed the song Montana Skies for us. And that's our very, really our first original song that we recorded and started working on.
So can you define music that you care about? I mean, is there, because you play a really broad range of music. I mean, Vivaldi's still in the mix, but so is Pink Floyd and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so an interesting question.
Is there a unifying principle?
I think if there's a unifying principle, I would say it's almost non-musical. And in the sense that maybe it's more conceptual, I've never put this into words before, but I'll try right now, and that, like, things like Pink Floyd have this unifying principle, and I think maybe the arts in general, of just celebrating our human experience and the commonality of that. And if there's anything that I think that Jen and I are trying to do, and you can chime in, Jen, if you feel different, but is to celebrate that in our concerts and just kind of take those 2 hours or so to immerse ourselves into the beauty of what music is and kind of celebrating that common humanity with everybody that shows up and us. And it's kind of a, you know, just a big party.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Jen, you mentioned Montana Skies, the first piece that you composed together, and it's now the name of the group.
Yeah.
So that must have some sort of importance to you.
Absolutely.
What does it symbolize?
A lot of things, really. It's so much more than just some sort of, it's not a geographical marker of where we're from. Like, neither of us are born in Montana or from Montana, but we have, you know, the history of it being the first song, and so that's meaningful right there. But then additionally, it's, you know, when we started thinking about what to name our group, it felt right for us because it had this feeling of no boundaries to it, the name itself, the expansiveness
Big
of the
sky country.
Yeah. And for us, with the fusion that we're doing with the music and not really having the boundaries of classical anymore, then we thought that that was descriptive of what the music is, which is, you know, an exploration, basically. So musical freedom. But then, as we've been sharing music and doing concerts, we've really come to feel like there's another element for us, which is that it really represents a lot about living your life from a place of joy. And for us, we have memories and connections and emotional aspects to our name, Montana Skies, which help remind us of coming from that place in our music, but also as people. So that's what it means to us.
Here's another original inspired by big spaces in the American West. It's called Canyon Breeze.
Thank you.
That's Montana Skies performing live in New Harmony earlier this year. We'll have more after a break. This is The Trend.
Support for WNIN comes from Morton Solar, a renewable energy solution provider for residential, commercial, governmental, and utility clients wanting to reduce electricity bills and lessen the carbon footprint. Located in Evansville, Indiana, Morton Solar provides consultation, engineering and design, and installation for projects throughout the tri-state area. Information on Facebook or at 812-402-0900.
You are listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're talking with John and Jen Adams, who form the classical fusion duo Montana Skies, and we're listening to excerpts of a concert recorded in New Harmony earlier this year.
There seems to be, and I guess, I mean, this started probably in the 90s to become, you know, somewhat mainstream, and certainly see a lot of it in the past decade or so, of classical musicians who are embracing non-classical forms of music and non-classical musicians who are embracing classical music. I mean, I think of people like Yo-Yo Ma, for instance, who has kind of broken out of the box with some of his projects, or someone like the mandolinist Chris Thiele, who has started performing the Brandenburg Concertos with a bluegrass group.
Right.
Where do you fit into that? And do you see in the conservatory and university environment, do you see more of a bending of lines and breaking out of boxes? Is this becoming the norm now?
I think, I can't speak that it's becoming the norm. I think that from our perspective, it's definitely influenced by those things. And Jen, as a cellist, has probably noticed this more because cello is a much more classical instrument than the guitar is in general. But I feel that the perspective that I'm coming at it from as a guitar player is that I had all of this background of rock music and things too, just as a guitarist, and then studied classical guitar at the same time. And so for me, I kind of see what we're doing as fusing those two elements a little more in a maybe less academic way, or that's the way I look at it anyway. Mm-hmm. And just kind of using the classical training to help inform, you know, the other aspects of my music, but still just kind of going for it.
I agree with you, Micah, that definitely it's like a new frontier in music, especially with instrumental music, more so, in my opinion, instrumental music, in that it's like a new genre that I think 200 years from now, it'll be an actual genre that is taught like the classical era of genres.
Yeah, just like Baroque or classical,
yeah,
or
I
romantic.
Think so.
Or, yeah,
definitely. Mm-hmm. I think it, and I don't know if it's going to be labeled classical fusion like what we call our music, but it's, you know, it's a term that could describe a lot of what you were talking about with the different groups going both ways. And that I think it's really exciting to be part of this time in instrumental music, because there's technology too, which I think is creating a lot of the inspiration for us all as musicians, because, you know, we use technology to express ourselves differently than if we were only with our acoustic instruments. So mm-hmm. We have my six-string electric cello, which is one thing that's totally different. And I can stand with it, and I have two extra strings, so I get to play fiddle things, violin things, cello things, then all the way down to bass things on it.
So the four original cello strings,
yeah,
are in the middle, and you
exactly.
have one lower and one higher?
Yeah, like a bookends on either side, exactly. And so that's super cool, and that's technology right there, and very innovative, and it allows me to express myself totally different. But then our group has amplification on both of our acoustic instruments, and that gives a whole other feel. And then we use the technology of computers and have Ableton Live that we use to create layers to our sound live. So we don't use anything pre-recorded. So it still has that feel of like what we were trained in as classical musicians, I think. And we, you know, create percussion and do different layers. So it's definitely something that I think other performers also are inspired by to do the fusion with, you know, all these cool instruments and technology and computers. So definitely.
And the cello, as you mentioned, for a long time has been pretty narrowly defined by classical music. And I feel like it might be coming out of its shell a bit when you think of people like Rashad Eggleston, who's just taken it in crazy directions, or like Natalie Haas, or, you know, someone like Mark Sommer and what he's done with sort of almost jazz in a quartet setting, traditional string quartet setting with Turtle Island. Who do you draw inspiration from, or do you feel like you're charting your own path here?
Oh, no, I draw inspiration from lots of people. I love listening to other musicians, and especially live. I've met Mark, I've met Rashid, and it's a smaller world. Once I started to go out and perform the alternative cello playing styles, I feel like I'm in a club, you know, and we have crossed paths with a lot of different people. But I agree with you, the cello's totally breaking out of its shell, and I am meeting young cellists, you know, all the time as we travel around, and they're very interested in doing things differently. They may not have tried it yet, but they're very interested in it. And then, you know, there's resources for them because now there's people out there doing things that they can learn from and use as their own platform to be inspired. But some of the people that inspire me are other instruments, actually, a lot of times. I love the players you mentioned, and Yo-Yo Ma, too, and all that. And then the oldies like Jacqueline Dupré. But I also am really inspired by like Jean-Luc Ponty on jazz violin, and Michael Hedges, and then going...
Fingerstyle guitarist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's just something about hearing another instrument, but playing similar style music to what, you know, I'm enjoying playing, and getting inspired by it. But music is inspiring all across the board. Maybe that's why our music is such a fusion, because we are inspired by so many different things like Bob Marley and Pink Floyd and all that.
Thank you.
John, I want to ask you about, you play the nylon string classical mm-hmm. guitar, and that is a less common or less popular instrument in the U.S. than the steel string or the electric. Mm-hmm. What does that allow you to do? What does that give you access to that, that you don't get from the more common types, at least in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. The nylon string is the traditional classical instrument, and so I have played steel string and electric guitar, but the nylon string I really like because of its versatility, kind of with the actual material of the string. It's made of nylon, so I can vary the tone colors and things like that. It also sets up a little better for me with just the finger spacing. And another aspect would be sort of using it as a flamenco sort of percussive instrument, which I like to do quite a bit. And the nylon strings really respond to that style of strumming and percussive attack.
Montana Skies performing Gringo Flamenco. I want to ask you about your relationship, because you're a husband and wife duo. Mm-hmm. And what's it like to play music with someone you're that close to?
I don't know what it's like to play with, you know, someone that I'm not that close to. I mean, because, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a joke, because, I mean, we both enjoy playing with other musicians still. But neither of us have toured with other groups. We've just been doing this, and I've only known this as my relationship with John. Like, it's woven in there.
That's how you met, was in college,
right?
Studying music.
Right. I feel like we're, very versatile in our relationship, so that we are bandmates and deep friends and husband and wife. Just, it depends on sort of what's going on. And I think that is what allows it to work as well. So it's not very restrictive in our relationship. It's very open, and we're both very much supportive of each other exploring their own life path and growth, so that, over the years we've gotten to be more, I think, kind to each other as well, which is essential. The kindness and patience and that, is essential. But the shared passion, I think, towards the music initially was a huge fuel for being able to have the time to grow in our relationship. So there was stressful moments maybe in the beginning that wouldn't faze us now at all, but because we were so fired up about the music, it was like, it made it work. Mm-hmm. It gave us the fuel to like learn how to deal with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I agree. I think that the concept of quote unquote husband and wife is just a concept, and it can sometimes maybe be stifling if that definition is filled with too many preconceived ideas from our subconscious upbringing. I mean, not to go too deep, but I just think we're two people that are living together, and it's a lesson in learning to treat the other person with kindness and respect, and ultimately we both just want to be happy, just like every other person in the planet. So it's just about learning to do that with each other, and hopefully with everybody else.
Right. And the music part, like, to answer more specifically to your question, it's just that the music is just part. It's like, that's who each of us, we each have that interest individually, and then it's just part of our relationship. But it's not probably influencing it too much that we, decided to have a relationship. Probably not. I don't know. But I do think that over time, because we've known each other for a long time, that we have a connection that's pretty deep. I would imagine that can happen with other bandmates too, whether they, sleep together or not. I don't know, but but we definitely have grown a lot over the years because we've known each other so long, and we've grown musically and personally. So.
You mentioned touring together, and you've played around the U.S. and Canada. You've also toured in Russia and Asia. Do audiences respond differently in different places? I mean, one always hears about music is the universal language, which mm-hmm. would suggest that we all understand it the same way no matter where we are. Is that true?
I think it is true. I mean, I don't really notice a big difference in response from place to place. I think people in general seem to love music the same everywhere and respond to it in a pretty similar way. So in that way, I think from my experience, music is that transcendent language that allows us to all connect.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you.
John and Jen Adams are the cello guitar duo Montana Skies. We heard excerpts of their Under the Beams concert recorded in February in New Harmony, Indiana. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. The show's producers include Ryan Reynolds, Carol Seiler, and Tony Voss. The theme music was composed by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.